This is the time set for argument on case number 85525 and 85656, United Healthcare versus Fremont Emergency Services. Ready to proceed? All right, then. All right, council then. So, all right. Just to be clear before we get started, right? So, as set forth in the order of setting the argument, each side will have 2 minutes uninterrupted at the very beginning of their argument, as well as an additional 15 minutes thereafter for a total of 17 minutes per side. With that understanding then, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes, please.
3 minutes, okay. So what'll happen is, we're starting at the 17, when it gets down to the 3 minute mark, you'll hear a tone and the yellow light will come on giving you a warning, but the time keeps running down potentially to zero if you're still standing there. Okay, with that understanding, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. John Hacker for the appellants. May it please the court. Team Health claims never should have gone to trial, certainly not without the evidence most relevant to the central issue being tried. That issue is the reasonable value of TeamHealth's ER services, which in Nevada as elsewhere must be determined by identifying the arm's length market prices for those services. And as courts nationwide have held, evidence essential to determining market prices in this context includes the party's other arm's length network contracts, as well as the provider's costs and profits and other issues. But the district court excluded all of that evidence and more from trial. In the court's view, the case was like a bank collections case where the bank's finances and other accounts would be irrelevant to the debtor's obligation. In the court's words, quote, the corporate structure, the rates, the excessive charges, their profitability, their business model, billings, agreements, negotiations, all of that is simply irrelevant to the defense in this case. But such evidence, Your Honors, was highly relevant, not only to determining reasonable value, but also to United's defense that its actions were perfectly commercially reasonable and should not be subject to punitive damages. But the problems run even deeper than that. Each of TeamHealth's legal claims also fails as a matter of law at the threshold. Briefly summarized, the implied in fact contract claim fails because, as in the recent Molina case from Texas, United never manifested any intent to contract with TeamHealth. Indeed, we are here, Your Honors, only because the parties failed to reach network contracts. The unjust enrichment claim fails because TeamHealth never provided any benefit to United. And the UCPA claim fails because the UCPA authorizes private suit only by an insured against an insurer, and TeamHealth is not an insured under any of the ERISA plans at issue here. And if it is, then the claim is preempted by ERISA. Finally, there is the $60 million punitive damages award, a breathtaking ratio of 23-1 to compensatories. This is a purely commercial dispute between sophisticated business entities involving only claimed economic losses fully compensable by ordinary money damages. On this record, punitive damages should not be permitted at all, and certainly not in an amount greater than a one-to-one ratio with the compensatory damages award. I'll begin, if I may, obviously I'll take any questions, but I'll begin, if I may, with what I think is the most categorical threshold issue in the case, and the most glaring error, that is the exclusion of the reasonable value evidence I already summarized. In Nevada, reasonable value is generally understood as, quote, market value, that's certified fire. And that further is understood to be any factor a reasonable business person would consider in valuing the service. Courts across the country have held in this context that reasonable value and market prices all must be determined according to multiple categories of evidence that were excluded here. Two of the most important are, first of all, the network rates of both parties, the provider and the payer, in their other network negotiations and network agreements.
Would the network rates really be germane when those are negotiated rates? How is that relevant to an out-of-network provider?
Right. Actually, they're the most relevant. I want to be clear that we're not saying the non-par, right, the other out-of-network rates are irrelevant. But the argument here would be that it's categorically impermissible to consider network rates, which are actually the most probative. That's what all the other cases have said, because they reflect arm's length negotiations between a willing provider and a willing payer. And that's what you're trying to identify when you're trying to, you know, imprint onto a relationship a price, a reasonable value of services where you don't have a contract. What you're basically doing, and we can talk about this later, but what you're basically doing is saying as a matter of law, we're going to create a contract of law. And so what you try to do is identify the market prices that out there as a proxy for the price that a willing buyer and willing seller would reach if they did reach a contract. You obviously don't have one, I get that. But what you're trying to do, according to this court in Certified Fire and courts elsewhere, is identify that market price. And that comes from the other network contracts. And I think it's critical to recognize in this context that nobody disagrees with that. Perhaps even more important, it's not just all the other cases out there, Your Honors. It's the Nevada legislature. And the U.S. Congress has said in adopting the Nevada legislature's case, the Surprise Billing Act, which requires the parties, it doesn't apply in this case directly except for the last month, but it's a policy judgment that when you're creating an obligation, a legal obligation by a payer to pay a provider under these circumstances, absent a contractual agreement, what you look to in the first instance, what you look to primarily is prior network contracts between the parties, right? The Nevada legislature and then the U.S. Congress came along and adopted a similar rule. The HHS adopted a similar rule by regulation that says that the principal most relevant evidence of what that market value of the services is the other network contracts, because they, unlike the out-of-network service, which is not between willing buyers and willing negotiators, willing sellers, the network contracts and network rates do reflect, literally reflect, a market-based negotiation. Now, it's not just one contract. You bring in all of that evidence. And I want to be very clear. We're, again, not saying that that's the only thing you're allowed to consider or any of that. The problem here is the jury was barred from considering it. If you're going to ask a jury to find reasonable value in Nevada, you need to ask the jury to consider all of the relevant evidence.
Did your expert testify to market rate and take into consideration those negotiated prices?
Absolutely. That was like the heart of his analysis. There was a number of things.
So the jury did hear testimony then about market rates. Then those market rates were then based on in-network negotiated contracts.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. Okay. Our expert looked at that, but he was barred from testifying to that. So there's an offer of proof. Basically, his expert report was made as an offer of proof. You can see the offer of proof at Appendix 27-100, which is 186 pages of the evidence that we would have put in, much of it about this, precisely this point. And yes, our expert looked at the other network rates, and based on his analysis, he determined that the payments that the defendants had made and authorized were consistent with network rates, which is not surprising because other network contracts are a principal basis for the rates that the defendants were authorizing. So it's absolutely highly prejudicial that this evidence, this most probative evidence, was excluded just right there in the deal report. Had that been introduced, the jury easily could have determined that there's no damages at all here because United's payments, the defendant's payments, were
consistent. That evidence went to both the restitution and the implied contract claims?
This question runs through all three of them because all three of them share whether it's a
reasonable value in the same
right
test.
If there's an implied in fact contract, their argument is, you know, that required reasonable value. If there's a quasi-contract, that required reasonable value, and that their argument that we violated the UCPA because we didn't pay reasonable value. So it runs through all of them. There are threshold legal defects with those, which I'd be happy to turn to briefly.
Well, address one thing for me. If there wasn't an implied contract, can you address unjust enrichment?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because I think it's quite clear there was not an implied in fact contract. It's important to distinguish those because there's just no basis for inferring that United ever wanted to reach any agreement to pay Team Health anything, particularly given the fact that we tried to reach a contract and didn't. So, yes, the question I think is better framed and understood as, should a relationship be implied at law, a contractual relationship be implied at law through an unjust enrichment claim? And the problem with that, Your Honor, is that in Nevada, as elsewhere, a fundamental requirement of unjust enrichment is that the plaintiff have conferred on the defendant a benefit for which it should be compensated. And the problem here is that nothing that Team Health did conferred on United a benefit. Absolutely, it conferred on the patients its patients the benefit of emergency medical services, but that's not a benefit to United.
What about the no balance billing?
So I honestly don't even, I don't mean to be disrespectful to your question. I've never understood that as an argument for why that's a benefit to United, because United's obligation to the plaintiff, to the its members is defined by the ERISA plan, right? That's what United owes, is the amount that's specified in the ERISA plans. And they can't argue. I know they try to, and it creates a bigger ERISA preemption problem for them, but they can't actually argue that we violated the terms of the plan. As soon as they say that, the case is preempted by ERISA. So as the case comes to this court, I think you have to assume, unless we go the risk of preemption, that we complied with the terms of the plan. So then the question is, having provided care to plan members whose entitlement is only what's under the plan from United, we fulfill our obligation to the members. The fact that they're not going to bill their own patients is not a benefit to us. It doesn't help us. In fact, they're just shifting the payment obligation over to us. They're saying, we're not going to make them pay. We want you to pay because of what we provided them. That's not a benefit. That's a cost.
But didn't United, United, as I understand it, accepted the claims and paid some amount on them, and the dispute is about how much should have been paid. So from United's perspective, they weren't just paying out of the goodness of their hearts, right? They were paying because they needed to pay based on something. Why were they paying anything?
Right, and that's the huge question here. The answer is they were paying because ERISA, because their duties under the ERISA plan required them to pay. And as I just explained, we sort of have to assume, unless we want to say the case is preempted, and we're happy to say that because we think it's true, but we complied with the ERISA plan obligations. What their argument has to be, and that's why we paid. We absolutely paid, and we accepted these claims as payable, and we fulfilled our obligations under the plans, mostly dictated by the employers. The employers were telling us what we had to pay. And so we fulfilled that obligation. What their argument is it has to be, in addition to what you owed and is enforceable under ERISA, there is a separate independent amount that Nevada state law required you to pay us. And here's that amount. And they said it was the full bill charges. Something in Nevada law, they said, says you had to pay us everything on top of what you agreed by contract to pay on behalf of members.
Well, but there was no contract that specified the amount of reimbursement, right?
Well, there was the ERISA plan specified the amount of reimbursement, either in explicit, a numerical, a certain amount, or as a percentage of Medicare, or very commonly would be a phrase like a percentage of a reasonable and customary amount, which then the plans typically define to include median network rates. So the plans were all, they were either said something like that, or it was a construction of the plans that is the administrators empowered to make. But all of that's governed by ERISA. If somebody says, wait a minute, you didn't, the plan said X and you only paid X minus one, that's an ERISA claim. And if anybody comes in and said they only paid X minus one, the case it has to be governed by ERISA. The argument has to be that you violated this independent obligation, whether it's a matter of implied in fact contract or unjust enrichment, just under Nevada law, you, the payer, should be paying something extra to the provider. And here's what that number is. And the problem here is nothing in Nevada law creates that relationship. They didn't provide a benefit that would justify that. And so there's no basis for.
Let's say, though, that we credit the unjust enrichment predicate. Can that be a predicate for punitive damages?
So I'm glad you asked that question, because I do want to turn to punitive damages. We submit the answer to that is no. That in Sprouse, what this court said, as a matter of Nevada common law and statute, is that only tort actions can justify punitive damages, not a contract action or an action that. So if it sounds in tort, that's when you can get punitive damage. If it doesn't sound in tort, said Sprouse, then you can't have punitive damages. This action doesn't sound in tort. It's an equitable claim that, if anything, is contract. It's called quasi-contract. What you're doing is implying a quasi-contractual relationship to justify the payment because of the benefit, but it's not based on the kinds of tortious conduct that justify punitive damages. The punitive damages award on its own terms, leaving aside the absence of any valid predicate for punitive damages, the award on its own terms, we think, is impermissible and certainly excessive under both Nevada law and the U.S. Constitution. It's impermissible at the threshold because, as in General Builders and other cases, this court has warned and held that you can't have, you shouldn't have punitive damages when you're talking about sophisticated businesses, a commercial dispute with no physical injury, no financially vulnerable plaintiff, as in those cases. And you just, that's not what punitive damages are for. And that's definitely what we have here. And an absolute bare minimum, if the court were to think that there's something here that justifies some amount of punishment, some amount of damage beyond the contract damages, which are the money damages, which completely remedy their injuries, it can't possibly be more than the one-to-one ratio, because the reprehensibility, that factor, the conduct here would have to be at the absolute bottom rung of any version of reprehensibility that I think this court or any other has seen. With that, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Dennis Kennedy, and I'm here with Taylor Bingham from Bailey Kennedy Law Firm. We're Nevada counsel for the respondent and real party in interest. The lead counsel in the matter from the Lash Goldberg firm in Florida are Justin Feinberg, who is here at the counsel table, and Jonathan Siegelaub. And Mr. Siegelaub will make the argument on behalf of the respondent and real party in interest.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jonathan Siegelaub on behalf of the plaintiff respondents. And before I get going, we passed a demonstrative up, which I believe you received copies of. Your Honors, there were three components to the judgment in this case. Each one of them should be affirmed. The compensatory award was fully supported. United had an obligation to pay reasonable value, and the evidence over a four-week trial with 18 witnesses and more than 200 admitted exhibits showed that United paid less than reasonable value. The punitive award was entirely appropriate. There was clear and convincing evidence of conduct by United involving oppression, fraud, and malice, and the amount of the punitives was appropriate and necessary to punish and deter United's abusive conduct. Finally, the plaintiffs were entitled to recover fees and interest under the Prompt Pay Act because the evidence showed that United only partially paid claims that were fully due and payable. Your Honors, I'll begin with the compensatory award, and I'll focus my argument today on the unjust enrichment claim. That was the first claim on the verdict form, and it's the principal claim in the case. Your Honors, Nevada law follows the restatement of restitution, and Section 22, Illustration 10 of the restatement is directly on point. It provides that where an out-of-network emergency provider renders care to an insured patient, the provider is entitled to payment from the payer at an amount equaling the reasonable value of the services. If the payer pays less than reasonable value, the provider can recover the difference in restitution. Your Honors, that is the precise situation that we're dealing with in this case. The plaintiffs rendered out-of-network emergency care to United's members in over 10,000 separate patient encounters. The jury reviewed extensive record evidence of reasonable value from fact witnesses and experts. That evidence included data showing the rates that United was paying to other out-of-network emergency providers in Nevada. The jury considered that evidence, and the jury determined that United paid less than reasonable value. That conclusion was fully supported by the evidence, and the court should affirm the compensatory award. And on the
what was the benefit received by United that was conferred by Team Health?
Sure, Your Honor. There were several benefits. One, there was a promise not to balance bill United's members, which benefits United, greater member satisfaction. There were also shared savings fees that United generated specifically by underpaying the medical providers. The way the system worked is that the less United paid to the plaintiffs, the larger the fee United generated for itself. So that was a benefit. And I'd note the court construction case where this court held that any advantage gained, no matter how small, is a sufficient benefit for purposes of unjust enrichment. But ultimately, the restatement is what's controlling here. Nevada follows the restatement, and the precise scenario we're dealing with in this case is addressed in the restatement, which says that there is a benefit and there's a restitution claim in these circumstances. Now, moving on to punitive damages, the plaintiffs were entitled to recover punitives on the unjust enrichment claim. NRS 42005 permits punitives on actions for breach of obligations not arising from contract. And Your Honors, an unjust enrichment claim is not a contract claim. It's a restitution claim.
In this case, isn't it really though? I mean, Team Health is raising a contract in, have raised the implied contract claim. So it seems like you're arguing both sides of that.
Your Honor, we concede that we're not entitled to punitives on the implied contract claim, but we are entitled to punitives on the unjust enrichment claim, because unjust enrichment is not a claim that sounds in contract. It's a restitution claim. That distinction.
If your implied contract claim is successful, you don't have an unjust enrichment claim, right?
The two cannot coexist, but the judgment that was entered only awards compensatory damages a single time. So there's an election between the two, and the unjust enrichment claim, again, is the principal claim in the case. That is the claim, the first one that was on the verdict form. And if this court affirms the judgment on unjust enrichment, which we believe it should, then the implied contract claim would go away. We would have an unjust enrichment recovery, and there would be potential punitives on that. Now, I heard the Sprouse case mentioned when opposing counsel was speaking. Your Honor, Sprouse deals with a different statute. That's a claim. That's a case that deals with 42010, which I believe is a statute that specifically addresses drunk driving accidents. But NRS 42005 is the controlling statute here. And the distinction between restitution and contract is clear in Certified Fire. It's clear in the restatement. And I'd note the Ninth Circuit's decision in Hester versus Vision Airlines, which we cited in our brief. The Ninth Circuit held in that case that punitives were available on an unjust enrichment claim because it's not a contract claim.
So even if we did find that punitive damages were appropriate in an unjust enrichment claim, how do you get beyond the three-time cap in 42.005? Because the provision that you cite to B, an insurer who acts in bad faith regarding its obligations to provide insurance coverage, don't really seem to fit here.
Well, Your Honor, I would just refer to the language of the statute. And you're entirely correct. It's the exception to the cap applies where an insurer acts in bad faith regarding the obligation to provide insurance coverage. Each of those criteria is satisfied here. United is an insurer. There was ample record evidence of bad faith conduct by United, specifically its shared savings program, its scheme with MultiPlan. I'd note the Potter case. Bad faith is where an insurer acts unreasonably and with knowledge that there's no reasonable basis for the conduct. And that's the situation here, because United knew it had an obligation to pay reasonable value. It knew how reasonable value.
It have that obligation to
the providers, the plaintiffs.
Didn't it have its obligation to its insureds, or perhaps to the employers and ultimately the insured employees?
Two separate obligations, Your Honor. So there is an obligation to United's clients, who are the ERISA plans, and to the members of those plans. And that is an obligation to pay what is provided under the plan.
Right.
There is a separate obligation under basic principles of restitution that flows directly to the providers. And that obligation is the basis for the unjust enrichment claim.
So your client and United didn't reach an agreement when they were renegotiating, or I don't know exactly what the course of negotiations were, but I know they ended up out of network. And so how, when two parties don't reach an agreement to continue a contractual relationship, how is there still an obligation that they have to you?
Well, Your Honor, that is the entire basis of the unjust enrichment claim, and that's what the restatement addresses.
But your clients weren't doing, like, unjust enrichment, at least sort of as I learned it in law school a long time ago, was about doing something where you're acting with the expectation that someone is going to be paying you for it. Here, T Team Health is required by law to provide emergency health care to people who come in and need emergency health care. Like, they weren't doing it because, oh, we're going to go do this because we know they're going to be paying us for it. Like, they're doing it because they have a legal obligation. Isn't that right?
Well, they're doing it because that's their job. They're emergency providers. And yes, they have a legal obligation to treat everybody that walks through the door. They can't ask about insurance status. They can't ask about what they're going to get paid. They have to treat the member. And so there is just an inherent inequity when United has an obligation to pay for the care, and it says, well, we'll pay for it, but we're going to pay an amount that's substantially below the reasonable value of the service, and you have no recourse.
They have an obligation to pay for it because they've entered an insurance contract with somebody else, not you.
Correct. And there is an obligation under just basic equitable principles that are set forth very clearly in the restatement, which is authoritative in Nevada, that says that in this scenario where you have an out-of-network emergency provider who treats a patient, there is an obligation on the part of the insurer to pay reasonable value, whatever that happens to be. And then you have a fact question about what reasonable value is. And that's what the entire trial was focused on.
So by being out of network, by not reaching an agreement with you, they end up without a contract and based on equitable principles, owing your client more than what they were paying under actual contract. Is that right?
Well, what they owe is the reasonable value of the service. So,
which in this case was argued and apparently determined by the jury to be more than the amount that they were actually paying when they were actually parties to a contract with your clients.
I think what you're asking about, Your Honor, is the distinction between in-network rates and out-of-network rates. And they're very different. The entire point of an in-network agreement is that the provider offers a discounted rate to the payer in exchange for certain benefits that the provider receives by virtue of being in the in-network relationship. And in a case where the provider is out of network and is not receiving the benefits, there's no basis for the discount. That's numerous courts have recognized that distinction. We cited the Geds case from the 10th Circuit, the HCA case from the 11th Circuit. And frankly, this court recognized that distinction in Corey versus Seastrand, which is the case we submitted, where it said that the discounts offered to insurers by a medical provider are not relevant to determining reasonable value out of network because they're two different things. So I'm not arguing, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs are entitled to whatever they want. They're entitled to reasonable value, which we agree with United, that is a market calculation. And there was extensive evidence in the record from which the jury could calculate reasonable value out of network. I'd note the evidence showed that United was simultaneously paying other out-of-network providers in Nevada more than double what it was paying these plaintiffs. And if you run the arithmetic on the verdict, what it shows is that the jury calculated reasonable value to be approximately what United was paying to other out-of-network providers in Nevada.
Go on.
No problem, Your Honor. I believe I was speaking a moment ago about the punitive damages. And I noted that this court should follow the Ninth Circuit in Hester, which held that there are potential recovery of punitives on an unjust enrichment claim because it's not a contract claim. And then factually, there was clear and convincing evidence of United's oppression, fraud, and malice. There was evidence that showed that United concocted its shared savings program, which was basically a kickback scheme where United generated fees for itself specifically by underpaying the plaintiffs. United enlisted MultiPlan ostensibly to calculate the rates so that it would appear that the rates were neutral and objective and fair, when the evidence showed that in reality, United was dictating the rates to MultiPlan and then pretending that MultiPlan had calculated them. The evidence showed that United colluded with an academic from Yale to publish a sham study, and United made the decision to name Team Health in the study as a bad actor for public shaming, but made a calculated decision to conceal its own involvement in the study so that the study would appear to be credible and objective. So all of that was malicious, bad faith conduct that fully supports a punitive award, And in particular, I would note that this scheme came from the highest levels of United. The entire point was to exploit the plaintiff's legal and ethical obligations to treat all patients. United knew that its members would be treated no matter what it paid, and it took advantage of that fact. But, Your Honors, the third component of the judgment was attorney's fees and interest under the Prompt Pay Act. And the Prompt Pay Act prohibits insurers, or where an insurer has adjudicated a claim as due and payable, the Prompt Pay Act says you have to pay the claim within 30 days.
But doesn't it only apply as between the insured and the insurer, not a third-party administrator? Or because there's other parts of the statute, the surrounding statutes, where it does say claimant, which I think is different from the insured. But in this particular statute of the Prompt Payment Act, the private right of action inures to the insured, not like a Team Health.
Well, the payment here is made directly to the medical providers who are the plaintiffs.
But what about the plain reading of the statute?
Your Honors, again, I would submit that because these plaintiffs are the ones bringing the claim, they're the ones that are entitled to prompt payment of the claim under the statute. And the statute is relatively straightforward. It says that there's a requirement to pay the full amount due. You can't make partial payment on a claim that's fully due and payable. And here the evidence shows that United knew it had an obligation to pay reasonable value. It knew how to calculate reasonable value, but it deliberately paid amounts that it knew were less than reasonable value because it wanted to generate shared savings fees.
If we determined that the Prompt Payment Act didn't apply, what would be the basis for fees?
For attorney's fees?
Yes.
I'm not sure there is a basis for attorney fees without the Prompt Pay Act. Those were awarded under the Prompt Pay Claim. Your Honor, the final thing I want to address is the evidence exclusions. Because the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying United's motion for a new trial. The court's gatekeeper function is to keep the trial focused on relevant issues, to admit probative evidence, and to exclude evidence that would cause jury confusion or prejudice. The discovery here took place over a course of years. It was managed by Special Master Wall. He fully understood the case. The district court understood the case. United had a full and fair opportunity to present its case on reasonable value. There was extensive evidence, as I mentioned, evidence showing what United was paying to others out of network. And the jury reviewed that evidence and ultimately concluded that reasonable value was what United was paying.
But why wouldn't the best evidence be the negotiated rate in between United and in-service people?
Once again, because an in-network
contract rate, it's reasonable, it's a market rate. And as I understand this, their expert was only able to opine about market rate without saying in part it based its opinion on the negotiated rate in an open market.
Again, Your Honor, an in-network rate is a discounted rate. It's not a rate that's designed to reflect the actual value of the service. It's a rate that's specifically discounted because the provider is getting certain benefits from the in-network relationship. And again, I would note the Corey case, this court recognized that discounts offered to third-party insurers by providers are not probative evidence of reasonable value. I believe my time is up.
It is indeed.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me start with the absence of evidence, the most probative evidence of reasonable value. Their argument is that there was some evidence of reasonable value, but the evidence that the Congress and Nevada legislature and courts across the country said is the most probative was not before the jury. The jury can't be expected to reach a sound judgment.
How could be the most probative that an amount that you couldn't agree on to move forward with the contract was the right amount for reimbursement?
So it's a good question because we're not talking about like a specific, you know, we wouldn't just put in the negotiations between us and say, here's where we were and you have to adopt this amount. What we're talking about is in the absence of a contract, if the argument is they provided a valuable service and they should be compensated for it, then you have to look to arm's length bargaining across everywhere, right? We're talking about bringing all the evidence, not just you know, split the difference between where we were before.
But I'm really struggling to see the benefit, to see how in-network compares to out-of-network, because they're very different, right? In-network, United is, in, you know, telling patients go these places because it's in-network. They get, you know, there's a lot of benefits to both United and the provider when there's an in-network contract that do not exist when there's an out-of-network contract.
There's benefits to both. Both sides want to reach a contract, and the fact that they didn't reach a contract doesn't mean you go with what, you know, the provider wants or demands, which is what they were saying, nor does it mean that other non-PAR payments in this case were really not very relevant, because they were all payments made before 2000, or all or mostly payments made before 2016, so not even in this period, and they're just based on what the plans say. That's what they're just payments based on what individual plans say. They don't reflect any joint judgment between market participants as to the value of the services. Remember, it's the same services, right? The value, what the network rates show is how the parties, when they are negotiating and trading both sides, both of their interests, what they think a reasonable value should be. And again, we're not saying you have to go with like one contract. Our point is, as this court has said, you look at all the factors a reasonable business person would think is relevant. And for example, if somebody says, you know, I'll mow your lawn, and you don't set a price and you try to figure it out later, what you're going to look at to figure that out is the prevailing rates around the, you know, around the neighborhood for lawn services. You're going to look at the lawnmower's costs of providing services. And that's true even if you're trying to imply a term into the contract, or if they like mow the wrong lawn and you're trying to say as a matter of unjust enrichment, what you're going to look at is the market rates. The jury here didn't get that evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.